Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
You know, cattle markets are obviously very strong. We're at nearly record levels, you know, across the board for feeder cattle, fed cattle.
Oklahoma State livestock economist Dr. Darrell Peel.
Feeder cattle, you might expect to see some seasonal weakness in the fall. We're certainly not seeing that yet. And the auction totals would suggest that we're getting into the, you know, the fall run of calves, if you will. The volumes are up seasonally for sure. So, you know, we're moving into tighter and tighter numbers. We think this thing has a long ways to go. You know, on a longer term basis, we're looking for evidence that we've started saving heifers, trying to rebuild this herd from the levels that we've been drawn down to. We don't see any indication of that yet. So, you know, and I don't really think it's going to happen in a big way this fall. We may start a little bit, but we're probably talking about things that are really going to take place in the coming, 2 to 4 years.
This is Agriculture Today.
Succession planning is really a process. It's not a one-time event. It's not something that you do one time, put it in the bottom drawer of the filing cabinet and say, yep, I have a plan and I never have to look at it again.
As part of a Nebraska Center for Ag Profitability webinar, Brandon Dirkschneider, President, Insurance Design Management.
Because every time that Congress or Senate goes into session and they start changing laws or the family dynamics change or family members change, that succession plan needs to get updated. But not only that, succession planning is really a process. And it's a process of identifying and developing the new leaders who are going to replace the older generation when they either decide that they want out, they want to retire, or maybe they become disabled, or they, as we all will, die and leave the operation. And in a family business, that can be difficult because a lot of times we treat that younger generation more as a hired hand rather than a leader or the next generation of leaders. So we really need to focus in on that mentoring process to really to help the next generation fulfill those key business roles and leadership positions. And within the operation, help them understand the why, help them understand why we make the decisions that we make, how we've gotten to the point of where we're at, and what decisions need to be made to help keep the family business in force or continue to grow the operation over the next decades to come.
But it really seems as though publications and news organizations focusing on succession. Why?
The reason why it's so important is we know today, with over 2 million farms over the American landscape, still 99% of those family are family farms, but only a third of those family farms have an actual transition plan in place. And with the demographic age of the American farmer getting older, we're actually going to witness the largest demographic shift of wealth our country has ever seen. You're going to see more assets change hands from one generation to the next over the next 20 years than you have ever seen before. And without the lack of planning, there's going to be working capital, cash flow, and assets that are going to be, could be negatively impacted, whether it's because of taxes, whether it's buying out family members without a plan in place. So, with that being said, we always talk about it. Well, it takes one generation to build that family business, second generation to maintain it, and it's the third generation that will maybe possibly use it. And that carries a really negative connotation to it at times. But with our American farm families, there can be a lot of truth to that. And a lot of truth statistically is because they're always buying out the non-active family members. My family even had that firsthand when my great grandfather passed away in 1977. He had 640 acres when he, at the time that he passed, but he had 8 kids and each kid inherited 80 acres. And at that time, when he split things equally, a lot of the family was, or the active farm family members were forced to buy out the inactive family members. And today, a lot of those acres currently aren't owned by my family. And it's one of the reasons why I myself are not farming today is because we didn't have a transition plan in place. So when this statistic or adage is thrown out, it's not because of a silver spoon syndrome, or it's not because they weren't fiscally irresponsible. It's because farm families do not take the time to say, okay, if I'm going to create an estate plan, what effect do those decisions in my estate plan have to affect the future cash flows or working capital for future generations? And that's really what succession planning comes about, is what are we trying to do? So when we talk about succession plans, we want to talk about what are those components? What are the components of a succession plan?
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
This week's topic is the Oklahoma Quality Beef Network. We are fortunate to be joined by Paul Vining, coordinator of the OQBN sales.
Oklahoma State beef breeding specialist Dr. Mark Johnson is host of SunUp's Cow-Calf Corner.
This is an interesting thing for producers in Oklahoma. It's an opportunity to capture some premiums whenever we're going to be selling our weaned calves. If we stick to some protocol and manage them accordingly, we're pretty well documented at this point, aren't we, Paul, about the premiums producers have received out of this program over the years. And I guess as we get started, what kind of premiums have producers been seeing going through the OQBN sales?
Well, so far, prices have been strong, as you know, just looking at the overall cattle market. Over the past several years, over the past 11 years or so, we've seen premiums average about $13 per hundredweight. So if that's a 500-pound calf, you're making around $65 just on the premium from OQBN alone. So that certification does add some value. So far, we've sold a few calves in some outside sales. I've helped some guys, and the premiums have been really strong. So they're happy, and I'm happy, and it's a good year.
As we get into that checklist of things that a producer would need to follow in order to get calves into an OQBN sale, what are those management practices that we need to work through?
So the calves need to be weaned at least 45 days. They need to be raised on the ranch of origin. Bull calves need to be castrated. Calves with horns need to be dehorned. And two rounds of vaccinations, so two rounds of respiratory vaccines with at least one of them being modified live. And we have three different protocol options you can check online or talk with me. And two rounds of blackleg, so two rounds of clostridial, and should be good to go.
And producers need to be BQA certified?
Yes, producers do need to be BQA certified. So you can get your BQA certification online or stop in at your local extension office, and we have some great educators that can help you get that. But yes, need to be BQA certified to participate in OQBN.
And as far as documentation that we follow these practices, how do we go about getting that done?
Well, we have a third-party verification. So an extension educator or area livestock specialist will come out to your farm, your ranch, and look at your calves, review your protocol, review your enrollment form, and your vaccination record, and conclude, you know, that you've met all the certifications, the requirements, and sign off on it. So that's our third-party verification. And that's where really OQBN kind of stands out and differs from a lot of other programs, is that we do have that third-party verification and support to help you and confirm that you've met all the requirements.
Sure. And Paul, the question we always get back to, we know producers can get a premium for doing this. Why does that stocker yearling operator want to pay that premium? What's the benefit of these calves going on through the chain?
Great question, and that's really kind of the point and the highlight of the program, is that those calves do remain healthier once they leave the ranch of origin. So when they go to the next phase of production, they remain a lot healthier. Studies have shown that percentages of bovine respiratory disease are less in these preconditioned calves, and it really just bolsters the reputation of the cow-calf producer and the organization as a whole. So
basically anything anybody needed to know about OQBN sales, you've got documented on that website.
That's correct. Yes, everything you would need to know about the program is there on the website. If you have any questions or have trouble finding or navigating that webpage, you can contact me. My information's on there. We have some great area livestock specialists. Their information is also on that webpage, and they're a great help to work with as well.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I do disagree with my friend that the issues to being brought up in this bill are trivial.
Oklahoma Representative Tom Cole is chair of the House Rules Committee on heated debate last week on defense spending.
Defending the United States of America is not a trivial thing. You can agree or disagree with the bill, and I'll talk about that in a minute, and that's fair enough. I don't consider that trivial. Providing natural gas in abundance and at modest prices to Americans and having that resource to deal with our adversaries overseas who often use weapon or energy as a weapon and to be able to provide for our friends and allies reliable energy is not a trivial matter. It's extraordinarily important matter. And the 10 million Americans that work in the domestic energy industry think what we're doing here is the right thing to do. So I don't consider their interests and their views trivial. I'm just very privileged to represent many people that have that point of view or involved in that and are involved in that particular profession. And finally, I don't consider, you know, standing up for the Second Amendment a trivial thing. You know, we have a governor that issues an order that immediately a federal judge overturns. And Democrats in New Mexico condemned. Elected Democrats, law enforcement officials, quite a bit of bipartisan. It's actually one of the areas, and what's usually a contentious issue, that we had really strong bipartisan agreement. So we think it's important to make that point. If my friends have a different point of view, that's fair enough. Then just express it and we'll move on. But again, we don't consider defense of the Constitution to be trivial. I will agree with my friend about a number of things, and we've had this discussion, frankly, as friends in the committee. I agree with him about shutdowns. I do not think it's an appropriate tactic, and I hope that we're able to avoid one. And there will be an appropriate time, I'm sure, when we discuss with our friends how and to do that. But we need a negotiating position. We're working toward that, and we hope we'll get there.
Representative Cole was addressing Jim McGovern, a representative from Massachusetts and the ranking member on the Rules Committee.
Yeah, we inherited a mess. We inherited your inflation. We inherited a record deficits. You know, pretty tough deal. My friends don't want to address them. Well, this majority is going to do its best to address those issues. And we do struggle and disagree. And sometimes I get frustrated with some of my friends on my side of the aisle about tactics they presume. You're right about one thing, and I will agree with you 100%. There is no objection to this rule on the basis of the rule. There's nothing wrong with it. 184 amendments. You can agree or disagree with the bill, but it's a good rule. There's, in my view, nothing wrong with the bill other than I would like to have spent a little bit more money, or like any bill that spends this amount of money, everybody could do it a little bit differently. People are trying to make other points unrelated to the bill. And I will agree with my friend, that's unfortunate. I don't think that's a good way to legislate. I think you should look at the legislation in front of you. If you agree with the rule, you ought to vote for it. You should, if you disagree, fair enough to vote against it. But if you agree with the basic bill, you don't relate it to something else and try and use it as a weapon. And we don't have many members that do that, but we have a few. And as my friend knows, we have a very narrow majority. You've been here once or twice yourself when you had narrow majorities. So it's part of the legislative process. We'll continue to work it. But my hope today is we'll advance this rule. It will open the way to advance what I think is a good defense appropriations bill, and we'll continue to move legislatively as rapidly as we can, and we'll work, and at the appropriate time, I'm sure, work across the rotunda with Democrats in the Senate and probably in this chamber with some of my Democratic friends, and hopefully we'll avoid a government shutdown. The most important thing, though, today, move the rule, move the bill. That's what we are going to try and do.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The second biggest aspect which most of our farm families need to take a look at and plan around is taxes.
Second, after trusts. Brendan Dirkschneider, President, Insurance Design Management in Omaha at a recent Nebraska Center for Ag Profitability webinar.
So when we think about taxes, there's a couple of different aspects when we think about taxes. One is our ordinary income tax bracket. And ordinary income taxes are taxes paid on income that you generate while you're actively employed or actively farming. So this graph here is showing you the top federal income tax rate from 1913 to 2023. And as you can see, through the 40s out through the early 80s, that top federal tax rate exceeded 70%. And then you'll see by 1988, it was below 30%. And then we've inched back up to above 40%, where we're at in 2023 is 40.8%. And one of the things that we're really experiencing for many of our farm families today is we're watching that bonus 179 depreciation disappear. So where many of our farm families were able to go out and buy a new combine, buy a new semi-truck, a new planter, a large piece of equipment, they were able to take that whole purchase price of that piece of equipment and wipe out their adjusted gross income and pay little to no income tax. Well, currently with the Trump tax laws expiring, that bonus 179 depreciation is going away. So this year, you can only take 80% of that purchase price, and the remaining 20% of the purchase price is set on a depreciation schedule. In 2024, another 20% will disappear, so you can only use 60% of the purchase price. In 2025, another 20%. In 2026, it will be gone. So that may force you into paying more of a federal income tax. But that's not necessarily a bad thing if it's managed correctly. Because as this chart shows, historically speaking, we're still in some of the lowest federal income tax rates that our country has ever seen. A husband and wife married filing jointly can still claim in excess of $380,000 just with the standard deduction and still be in a marginal rate of 16 to 17%. Considering where tax rates may go, especially if you look at how we're going to try to pay down the federal deficit, it's not a bad idea to start paying some of that federal income tax today through some of the, through some of those lower brackets. The other benefit of paying tax on some of that income today, as we lose that bonus 179 depreciation, is you're also paying FICA tax. And FICA tax is a tax that your Social Security benefits are based on. And your Social Security benefits are based on your highest 40 quarters of earnings or the last 10 years. And if you have that FICA tax paid and it's higher than maybe what has typically been normal over the last 10 years, your Social Security benefits should also increase. And if your Social Security benefits increase, that's going to be less cash flow that's needed from the farm operation to maintain the patriarch and matriarch's financial independence. So even though it hurts to pay that 15.3% of FICA tax, if we can do it correctly and do an appropriate planning, we should be able to see an increase in your Social Security benefits, which is then less cash flow out of the operation. So from a planning perspective, being proactive in trying to figure out where we're where our assets need to be from a financial independence standpoint, what our cash flow needs are, and how do we do it on the most tax-effective basis from an ordinary income tax level, becomes very important with the succession plan.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Placements in the month of August were about 95% of last year. Marketings were 94% of last year. And the September one on feed total is 98% of last year, down 2%.
Oklahoma State livestock economist Dr. Darrell Peel on the latest cattle on feed report.
You know, for the most part, this report was pretty well anticipated. The placements were maybe just a tick higher than some people thought, but it was within the range of estimates. So I don't think it's a big surprise, really. You know, the overall comment I would make is that we are, you know, continuing to see what we've been seeing, which is a very slow tightening of these cattle on feed numbers. We're still only down 2% on a year-over-year basis, but we continue to, you know, work our way a little bit lower as we go forward.
Now, auction markets have seen increases in 2023.
Cull cow market has moved higher this year, just like all the other cattle markets. So we've got these cull cows at, you know, boning cull cow. So kind of in a middle of the road, cull cow right now is bringing about $1.08 to $1.10, depending on their dressing percentage. And, so they're at very, very lofty levels. Breaking cows, which will be the younger, fatter cows typically bringing above that. And if they come in really lean right now, then they'll bring a little bit less than that. But all of these are at elevated levels.
Talking about auctions and then also talking about slaughter, those numbers are down from pretty high highs we had in 2022.
Yeah, you know, we had record beef production in 2022 that was based on slaughter, which was driven by the drought liquidation that we had. So we were sort of pulling inventories down and pulling cattle forward because, you know, we marketed calves early and so on. Now we're seeing, you know, steer slaughters down, heifer slaughters down some, but not that much yet. That's the slowest one to come down. Beef cow slaughter is down significantly so far this year, about 13%. Dairy cow slaughter is the only class of cattle that's actually up on a year-over-year basis. So you have to look over into the dairy market to kind of explain that. But when you look at the beef part of it per se in terms of the various classes of cattle, we're down across the board. Year-to-date, total cattle slaughter is down about 3.9% for the year so far.
But should we rethink culling cows?
You know, it's the time of year when we're going to be marketing cull cows, and there's a couple of things that producers might consider. They are worth a lot in pretty much any stage that you find them right now. because of the way the market typically moves. Now, I said earlier, I don't think we'll see as much seasonal pressure this fall, but to the extent that we are a little bit lower seasonally, if you hang on to them after culling, feed them and put some weight back on them, you'll sell more pounds for more money typically from the, you know, from about a November low into the first part of the next year. You might raise them depending on how much weight they gain. You might raise them up a grade in terms of their classification, and they'll bring even more money. And then, you know, on top of that, we're moving into a very tight breeding cow market situation. And so if you leave a bull with those cows while you're feeding them and putting a little weight on them, and, you know, some of them very likely will get pregnant. Maybe they fell out of your herd because they didn't get bred on time or stay in with the rest of the herd. But if a cow gets bred over the winter, you could probably sell her next spring for even more money.
What are the considerations, though, for keeping a cull cow?
You know, a lot of it comes down to sort of the details of, if you're going to keep those cows, then you got to be able to take care of them. So there's management and resource consideration. Do you have the feed? Some producers may have some excess feed. You know, cows are a pretty good way to utilize some sort of moderate quality hay. Maybe you got some leftover hay that's not the best quality. You'll have to have a little supplement to go with them. But, you know, cows can utilize that lower quality hay, and that's a good way to add value back into some of those medium to lower quality hays.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The defense spending bill, which is the most extravagant defense spending bill ever, failed a rule vote on Tuesday because the Republican conference is in absolute chaos.
Jim McGovern is ranking member of the House Rules Committee, member of the House Ag Committee, on the floor last week.
Best I can tell, no one on the other side of the aisle has any objection to the top line number in the Pentagon bill, but yet they voted down the rule just the other day. I know that whipping votes can be difficult, but the number of backroom secret deals and late night seances Republicans have had to hold this year to revive bills from the dead is astounding. And I'm afraid things will only get worse as we near September 30th. Republicans are acting like the end of the fiscal year just snuck up on them. Newsflash, the deadline to fund the government isn't some big secret. They've had months to prevent a government shutdown. But the reality is that not once have Republicans given us a bill that can keep the government open. Republicans barely control one half of one branch of government. And yet, you know, they act like they're king of the hill. Like it's their way or the highway, that nothing else matters. The only way this slim House Republican majority can keep the lights on is if they get Senate Democrats and the president to agree. But they haven't even begun to reach across the aisle to negotiate because they're busy negotiating amongst themselves. Hell, at this rate, they might not even be able to get Senate Republicans to agree, given how extreme their conference has become. Madam Speaker, this majority is a failure. The clowns are running the circus. The day Speaker McCarthy handed his gavel over to the clown show, this was the inevitable outcome. But there is a different path that we can choose right here and right now. Work with Democrats to prevent a shutdown. Work with us to keep the government open. Work with us to honor the deal you made earlier this year. It is time for the ringmaster of the circus, Kevin McCarthy, to stand up to the clowns and say, enough with the extremism and the blackmail. Stop wasting time and work with us to get this done in a bipartisan way.
Now, the chairman of the Rules Committee is Tom Cole from Oklahoma.
We agreed on top line numbers. We didn't say we're going to the top line numbers. We said, this is the top line number. Guess what? I suspect each side is positioning for a negotiation, and magically, we probably won't be too far off if we come to an agreement of the numbers that are laid out in the debt ceiling deal. So I'm not telling you this is the most efficient way to legislate, but I've seen it before, and we're seeing it from both sides right now. In terms of the budget, I tell you what, I'm interested in the opinions my friends have on the budget because they didn't bother to do one for the 4 years they were in the majority. So I'm thrilled they're actually marking up a budget in budget committee. And I give Chairman Arrington a lot of credit for doing it. It's hard to do. My friend didn't do it for 4 years because they couldn't do it, because they couldn't come to an agreement. As a matter of fact, I remember those 4 years. I used to serve on the budget committee. You couldn't get a budget committee or budget out of the budget committee that you controlled. I would agree with you. We should probably be sitting down and figuring out ways to run our fiscal affairs better, and particularly to do it in a more cooperative way, because, as my friends point out, you do control the United States Senate. You do control the United States presidency. But please don't lecture me on how you do budgets when you had the House, the Senate, and the presidency and could not write a budget in 4 years and get it out of your own committee, let alone bring it to this floor. And some of those years, you weren't operating with a five-seat majority. You just couldn't get the job done. So we're trying. I commend the Budget Committee. I hope they bring one out here. I'll be disappointed if they don't, but at least they're making the effort.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
BLS stopped producing those data in 2011.
Dr. William Beach, former commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
And at that time, they for the green jobs data which they were producing, they found that there were about 2.1 million green jobs in the United States. That's 2011. I took the liberty of just updating that number. And when you update that number for the larger labor force, you get about 5 million green jobs in the country. There are many different ways of figuring out what the green jobs are, but you're going to want to have that detail. I produce a chart in my written testimony that lays out all the occupational characteristics that BLS was able to produce. It is crucial if you're going to pursue the area of green jobs in a systematic way as congressional policy that you have those data in front of you. But they're costly.